picture I remembered all too well when it was taken. I'd been pretty badly beaten up the night before, and at the time was in prison. This was all quite apparent in the picture. But after I had boarded the plane and we were aloft, I often do these days, took out my Bible to read to pass the moments in flight. And as I was reading, I guess I'd read about three or four verses when the little stewardess came by, stopped at my seat, and she said, "Beg pardon, sir, is that a Bible you're reading?" I said, "Yes, it is." She said, "Would you mind if I took a look at it?" I said, "No, not at all," and I handed it to her. And she started thumbing through the pages, and then I remembered the photograph. And I held my breath. And the farther she flipped along through the pages, the less breath I had. Till finally the inevitable came to pass. She flipped over the last few of the pages, and there was the picture. She took a good look at the picture. Then she turned to look at me. Then she turned back and looked again at the Bible, finally turned back and rather suddenly exclaimed, "Oh, no, it can't be." I said, "Oh, yes, it is." She said, "Well, I don't quite understand." She said, "You know, I remember reading something about you in Life magazine not very long ago, but the story I read wasn't one that painted you as a Bible-reading individual." I said, "Well, that may be true, but you see, a lot has happened since then." And she said, "Like what?" And I turned in my Bible, and I pointed to a verse of Scripture where it says, "Therefore, if any man be in Christ, he is a new creature. Old things are passed away. Behold, all things have become new." She still didn't quite understand. She slipped into the seat next to mine, and for the next 400 miles, I told her the story of what God had wrought, what he can do, what he could do for her. The same story I'd like to share with you in these few moments this evening. I was born and raised in the city of Los Angeles. Before completing my schooling at the University of California at Los Angeles, I was in trouble quite a number of times for various violations of law, committed to prison. The most serious offense, one of having committed an armed robbery, in which I was committed for a rather lengthy period to work in a prison road gang. Upon the completion of that sentence, I went back to finish my schooling. And then upon the completion of my schooling, or very near to it, in fact, just a month or a little less than a month after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, I was drafted by the United States Army. And for several years that followed, served with the armed forces. I was, in spite of a record of a conviction of a felony, commissioned as an officer within the Army, and then 3 years later, while serving in grade of captain, I was court-martialed by the Army for misuse of government priorities and misappropriation of government property, and sentenced by court-martial board to be dismissed from the service, to forfeit pay and allowances due and to become due, and to be confined at hard labor for a period of 10 years. The place of confinement was designated as the McNeil Island Penitentiary. However, it was a year later, after incarceration there, my case was reviewed by the President of the United States. He felt that the sentence was too severe, issued a presidential pardon, and ordered my return to military service. It was a year later, after spending that year touring colleges and lecturing for the Air Force on developments in the field of electronics, it was that year later that I was finally honorably discharged from service, went back to Los Angeles there to open a business of my own as an engineering consultant in my chosen field, electronics. I worked primarily in research and design of electronic equipment for various industrial applications. However, it was shortly after the beginning of this business that I was approached by the Los Angeles Police Department. They wanted me to aid them in development of equipment for a scientific investigation of crime. In their behalf, we developed a number of devices which are still in use today. Equipment, for example, that made it possible to listen to telephone conversation without being near the telephone. We could be on the other side of the city, single out any designated telephone number, pick up and record both ends of the conversation, and determine electronically what number they dialed on the automatic exchange. All of this without a physical connection to the telephone line. Other equipment made it possible for us to follow an automobile. Instead of the old-fashioned way of getting behind a car to follow it and to pursue a suspect in a crime, we could, by this means, electronically pursue the car, tell every time they started, every time they stopped, when they turned right and when they turned left, pick up the conversation in the car, and in our car that followed some several miles behind, we could record what they talked about. It was equipment of this type, many other similar devices, that soon brought the attention of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Office and various police departments across the country, various federal agencies. The work became quite interesting, rather varied, however limited in what they could afford to pay due to limitation in city, county, state, federal budgets. Consequently, I took interest in doing work for private detective agencies. Initially, this was prompted by a call to one such agency out on the Sunset Strip in Hollywood, where a retired New York police captain who was operating this agency introduced me to a motion picture actor by the name of Mickey Rooney. Rooney was accompanied by his agent, but did most of his own talking. He said, "Mr. Voss, I understand that you have a device that makes it possible to listen to telephone conversation without being near the telephone. Is that true?" I told him it was. He said, "Now I further understand that you could set up right here in this office and 5 minutes from now be listening to any telephone number in Beverly Hills. Would that be true?" I told him it was. He took out his wallet and a $500 bill, laid it on the desk, then took a piece of paper and wrote the number Crestview 62002. He said, "Now, if in the next 5 minutes you could be listening to this telephone number, record what you hear, the $500 is all yours." Well, I'm kind of a large man, but when occasion calls for it, I can move rapidly. And I felt that this was one of those occasions. About 5 minutes later, we had the equipment set up and we were listening to Crestview 6202, whatever the number was he gave us, and recorded the conversation. Well, at the time, Mr. Rooney wanted a divorce from his wife, and our laws are such that upon separation or divorce, community property must be divided equally between husband and wife. This amounted to hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars, worth of property. And the only way that he could get out of that would be, of course, to prove that there were some unusual circumstances involved in the separation or divorce. And he was interested in proving these unusual circumstances. The recording was between his conversation between his wife and another man. It was ample evidence of what was going on, but it was not sufficient evidence that he could introduce in court of law. However, he took the recording home, threateningly dangled it over the head of his wife. She settled out of court, saved him hundreds of thousands of dollars. He was pleased, paid us not only the $500, but a sizable sum in addition. And then the word spread rather quickly through the Hollywood film circle as to the service we'd rendered to Mr. Rooney. and soon we had a number of interesting clients. men like Errol Flynn and Xavier Cugat and Dick Hames, and each time someone new with outstanding name or reputation would come to us and get away with, so we kept upping the fees, feeling that if it ever got to the place where these fees were considered exorbitant, we could always take the information we gathered for him, sell it out to the other half of the family, and she'd always pay off. It became a very profitable business. And soon we were doing work not only for these prominent personalities in Hollywood, but for businessmen that were curious about competitors in business, politicians that wondered about political opponents. And finally there came a time when I received a telephone call to a place of business out on the Sunset Strip known as Michael's Haberdashery, very famous little men's store, not so famous for its merchandise and the quality, although that was outstanding, but because of its proprietor, who had by this time earned a reputation of being the leader in organized crime in the western part of the United States, his name Mickey Cohen. I was curious as to what he wanted of me and went to his place of business, was ushered through his very plush little store into an office in the rear. And there, seated behind a massive semi-circular desk, was this man Cohen. I was given a seat in front of the desk and he started firing questions. He said, "I'm informed that you're the man that plants microphones for the police department. Is that true?" And I told him that it was. He said, "Now, I'm told that you're the man that installed one of these microphones in my home for the police department. Is that true?" I told him it wasn't. I wasn't the man. I hadn't put the microphone in his home. I didn't even know where he lived, knew little about him other than what I'd read in magazines and newspapers. And I was inwardly hoping that he'd believe me, because around the wall stood seven men, a little larger in size than myself, and the position was one that was not too comfortable. But he didn't seem too upset by my answer, and incidentally, I wasn't the man that put the microphone in. But he went right on to his next question. He said, "Well, Mr. Voss, maybe you're not the man that installed the microphone, but I have it on good authority. There is one in my home. The police and FBI listen to everything I have to say. Now, I'm wondering, could you come over, find out where that microphone is hidden, and take it out?" I said, "You get me all wrong. I'm in the business of putting them in, and I never take them out." Well, he reached into his pocket and pulled out a roll of $100 bills, and he started peeling them off one after another. He said, "Mr. Voss, you sure you're not interested in looking for the microphone?" Well, my interest suddenly changed, and a short time later, I was busy conducting the search for the microphone. Located it, removed it. It was this incident that caused Mr. Cohen to later offer me a full-time job in his employ. The job was one that was attractive as far as what he offered in dollars and cents. It exceeded my total income from all other sources. However, I offered to accept with one stipulation, my stipulation being that I be permitted to continue my work for law enforcement as well as to work with him in organized crime. He agreed, and so for a year that followed, that's the way it was, working both ends from the middle, or the middle from both ends. The work continued along this line for some little time. And then, of course, it became impossible and exceedingly difficult under the circumstances. I finally quit my work for law enforcement, and from that time on devoted all of my time to work in organized crime. Naturally, I could spend a lot of your time telling you interesting stories of the inner operation of so-called syndicated crime in America, but sufficient to say that I was due on the 10th of November in 1949 to put into operation a combination of teletype equipment and electronic components that made it possible to intercept and to delay transmissions on a teletypewriter network. Men from St. Louis had approached me desiring to know if it were possible to design and perfect such equipment. And we spent about 4 months perfecting it, then tried it in Arizona. It worked with such success in controlling a single city. You see, what they were trying to do was intercept these news transmissions on a teletypewriter network. And by intercepting them and holding back the news a minute and 40 seconds, they would get the result of a particular horse race and then notify key men as to the result of that race, giving them opportunity to place bets on that horse. And then a minute and 40 seconds, 2 minutes later, they'd let the news go through. And, well, over in our country, we call it pass-posting the bookies. I don't know what you'd call it over here, but it was quite successful, and in just controlling a single city that way meant a profit of thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars in one day. They were interested in the control of more than a city, so we moved into the state of Nevada in an attempt to control the state of Nevada, and then, greedy for greater gains, moved to St. Louis. That is, all of the equipment was shipped to St. Louis. The necessary manpower to control the western part of the United States was distributed throughout that area. And I was due on the 10th of November to put this equipment into operation. However, it was on the 6th of November in 1949 that I attended a meeting conducted by Dr. Billy Graham, and at that meeting made this decision that so completely changed my life. As a result of that decision, well, the newspapers carried it in their rather strange ways. You never can tell about the headlines of a newspaper. I recall the day that followed that decision, they came out with one in Los Angeles that in big type said, "Gangster gets religion." And then another newspaper came out with one that said, "Wiretapper hits the sawdust trail." And I think another one had it, "Cohen henchman sees the light." They had a lot of different ways to express it, but all of these were but rather blunt testimony to the fact that the people that wrote the article knew nothing about what they were talking about. And it is difficult for one that has not had similar experience to express in words what actually takes place. But sufficient to say that I had attended this meeting, and this farthest from my thought. Interestingly enough, my parents, a godly mother and dad, had invited me to hear Mr. Graham a month before, and I had refused their invitation, had long since concluded that their ways were too old-fashioned, too straight-laced. It wasn't for me. And then I read in the newspaper, as I read it one day, of the story and conversion of Stuart Hamlin. It had a picture in the paper and a caption underneath that said, "Hamlin gets religion." Well, I was rather amused, because I knew that if anyone ever got religion, it wouldn't be Stuart Hamlin. The reason I was so certain was that I knew this fellow Hamlin real well. He had a 2 to 3 hour broadcast every day over one of our big radio stations, and was well known for the songs he wrote, the most of which were a little on the shady side. And I said to my wife at the time, "Well, if anyone ever gets religion, it won't be Stuart Hamlin." I knew him too, because he had a dance band, and knew him too because our paths used to cross in some questionable places from time to time. He owned a prize string of thoroughbred racehorses. Well, I just laughed, turned the pages of the paper, and went my way. It was a number of days later, I was riding along through the streets of Los Angeles in my automobile. Excuse me. And dialed the radio to the station where his program was being aired. And it was time for them to give a commercial announcement for a liquor company, and he refused to give the commercial announcement. And when it came time for a commercial announcement for a cigarette company, he started out by saying, well, folks, if you smoke these things, you might just, no. How was it? He said, if you don't smoke these things, there's no use starting. And if you do smoke them, you might just as well quit. And continued to follow a pattern of remarks along this line, and sounded very much out of place. But a few moments later, he said to his fellows that sang on his program, a dance band and a chorus of fellows that sang a lot different than this, I assure you. He said, fellas, I've got a new song I'd like you to sing. Well, when Stewart said he had a new song, brother, you could expect anything. He had one that was quite popular at the time. It went, I won't go hunting with you, Jake. I'd sooner go chasing women. Well, you never knew what to expect. It could be most anything. And I thought, well, here it comes. And then they started to sing. But it wasn't a new song at all. I'd heard it before. Maybe it was new to them, probably the first time they'd ever saw us, sang or played it. It was, what a fellowship, what a joy divine, leaning on the everlasting arm. And to hear that jazz band playing it, and these fellows singing it, was different, I assure you. And a few moments later, Stuart Hamlin was telling the whole of his radio audience of the decision that had changed his life, announced that he was selling his prize string of thoroughbred racehorses, that he was giving up 21 consecutive years in radio broadcasting, all of this because of this decision that he'd made. It was all I could hear. I went my way, turned the radio off. But in the days that followed, a number of circumstances went together that caused my attendance of this meeting and the ultimate decision that followed. In my life, there were several things that I wanted more than anything else, I'd always said. I wanted to have a big home in the country. I wanted to entertain my friends in rather lavish style. I wanted to be able to drive a Cadillac convertible. If I had this and plenty of money in the bank, I'd be real happy, I said. The days that followed and the income that was mine, it didn't take long. The home in the country, the money in the bank, the big car. And this gnawed away at my heart, but at the conclusion of the message that night, he gave an invitation for people to come and stand at the front and by so standing indicate their desire to receive Christ as Savior and Lord of their living. And while he gave that invitation, the people stood and talked, and as they sang, a little elderly man came up to where I was standing and tapped me on the shoulder. He said, brother, are you saved? Don't you want to go forward? And it made me mad. I always thought that these things were rather private and certainly no one else's business. And for this one to come intruding into my life, my first thought was, well, brother, you say one more word. I had it all figured out. The place in the sawdust where he was going down and the place in the side of the tent where I was going out.